Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Tonight we're going to approach one of the most familiar passages in the Old Testament, but as frequently happens, familiarity also has a lot of baggage that goes with it, because the fact that we're familiar with it makes it easy for us just to assume the traditional interpretations, because that's the way it's just always been interpreted. You just grew up hearing it that way, therefore that must be what it means. John 3:16, God so loved the world, that must mean what I think it means, because that's what I've always been told it means, and I've always believed that's what it means. And then, you know, Jeff and I come along and say, no, it doesn't mean that. And people go, no, it must mean that. That's what it's always meant. Well, we're going to bump into one of those passages tonight, one of those really well-known traditional passages, the sacrifice of Isaac. And because we've heard so often in our church life about Abraham sacrificing his only son, there's a whole lot of traditional baggage that goes with that. I'm going to try to sort through the baggage tonight. First off, there is no New Testament interpretation of the signs, symbols, and emblems of this story. There is no biblical interpretation of it. And so when I, again, pull these rugs out from under your traditional reading, it's going to make you kind of uncomfortable for a moment. You're going to go, no, Jim, it has to be that way. But wait till I hit the conclusion. I think you're going to see, for instance, I'll just go ahead and blurt all this out ahead of time, and then we can deal with it. The common assumption is that because Isaac is referred to as Abraham's son, his only son, that makes everybody go, well, then he's a type of Christ. I've heard that my whole life, that Abraham being willing to sacrifice his son, his only son, is typological of God being willing to sacrifice his son, his only son. And when you mess with that tradition or that interpretation, people get upset. Now, there is a Christological figure in the story, but it's not Isaac. Isaac is a symbol of something, and I'll tell you what it is when we get there. But he is not a symbol of Christ. There is a symbol of Christ, and there is a symbol of substitutionary atonement. Now, we have to start, in order to get there, we have to start at chapter 21, verse 22, because that's where we left off last week. And this is a continuation of Abraham and Abimelech dealing with each other, and you're going to see them make an agreement, a covenant. This is one of those places where you see human beings making covenants with each other. Abraham apparently has learned to do this covenant-making thing as a result of dealing with God, making a covenant with him. Abimelech, we're introduced to him in chapter 20. Abimelech is the local king of Gerar. When he was there, Abraham had said that Sarah was his sister, and Abimelech took her to wife. And then Abimelech was not allowed to lay with her, and God took credit for that and said, I know you haven't touched her because I didn't allow you to sin against me. Remember that a couple weeks ago? Well, now Abimelech is reintroduced into the story. Starting at Genesis 21, verse 22, it came to pass at that time, this is after Isaac has been born, after he's been told, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called, after the son of the bondwoman and the bondwoman being cast off, after that, it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, his chief captain of his host, spoke unto Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Why did they get that impression? Because God spoke to him, a heathen king, and said, I kept you from sinning against me. Now go to Abraham and get him to pray for you. And then Abraham prayed for them, and all the time that Sarah had been with Abimelech, God had closed all the wombs of all the women in the household so that nobody could have babies until Sarah was out of there. And then Abraham prayed, and they had children again. So it was very clear from Abimelech's standpoint that whoever this Abraham guy is, God is clearly on his side. That being the case, Abimelech wants to make a deal. He wants to make a deal with them and say, okay, clearly God is on your side. Would you please promise me that you and your people are always going to be good to me? And here's how it plays out. God is clearly with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear unto me here by God that thou will not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son. He's asking for three generations of just promise me that you're going to deal truly with me. Because clearly God's with you. And if we ever have a problem, we've already seen that God can stop us, withhold us, close the wombs. Your God is clearly more powerful than any of our false gods. So we want to make a deal all the way down to the grandchildren's generation. We want you to deal with us well. According to the kindness that I have done unto you. Do you remember what that kindness was? He gave him gifts. He gave him animals. And then he said, anywhere you want to live. Anywhere you want to live in all this area of Canaan that I have rule over, just pick a spot. Whatever's good for you is good for me. So he says, according to the kindness that I have done unto you, you shall do unto me and to the land wherein you have sojourned. And Abraham said, I will swear. But in the next verse, Abraham reproved Abimelech because of a well of water. We're going to find out in a moment that this is a well that Abraham himself dug. But now he explains it to Abimelech that Abimelech's servants had violently taken it away. So his servants came in and took the well because, again, water's going to be scarce in that area. If somebody digs a successful well, you're going to send in armies. You're going to take that well because that's going to keep everybody alive. Verse 26, Abimelech said, I did not know that this thing had been done. Neither did you tell me anything about it. Neither did I hear about it except today. So he's really pleading his cause. I knew nothing. Nothing. I didn't know that was happening. So Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and both of them made a covenant. What would be the significance of the sheep and oxen? They'd have cut them open and walked through them. That was the whole point of the sheep and oxen. Cut them in half and walk through them. The phrase, and they made a covenant, implies the death of the animals and the walking through of the dead animals, forming the agreement between the two of them that they would both hold up their end of the agreement. And Abraham then, verse 28, set seven ewe lambs of the flock by themselves. And Abimelech said unto Abraham, what mean these seven ewe lambs which you have set by themselves? And he said, for these seven ewe lambs, you will take them from my hand, that they may be a witness unto me that I have dug this well. In other words, if there's ever a question that I ever told you at some future date that this is my well and I dug it for my people, my family, my army, my servants, my folks, if there's ever a disagreement, you're going to walk away with these lambs that are going to be a constant reminder that I gave you these lambs on the day we agreed that this is my well. So this is like a surety that this is my well, and you're never going to be able to say someday, oh, I didn't know. Oh, you didn't tell me. Oh, really? Verse 31, wherefore he called that place Beersheba, because there they swore, the both of them. Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, and they returned into the land of the Philistines. And Abraham planted a grove at Beersheba and called thereon the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. And Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. And that takes us to chapter 22, verse 1. And it came to pass after these things. Now the King James says, you'll have to check your translations, the King James there says that God did tempt Abraham, which has caused people a lot of consternation, confusion, because James is very clear in the New Testament to say when a man is tempted, never to say that he's tempted of God. God tempts no man. God can't be tempted to sin, and God doesn't tempt a man. The Hebrew word that's translated tempt in the King James is the word for test, or the word for try. It's the exact same word that's used when it says that David tried or tested Saul's armor and recognized that he couldn't wear it. And so what God set out to do here with Abraham was to try him, to confirm him, to test him, but not to tempt him, because temptation has at its root the idea of causing one to fall. What he was doing here was testing Abraham. Now, why would God at this particular juncture feel that it was necessary to put Abraham to a test? If you think of everything we've heard about Abraham up till now, you're really getting a very consistent personality profile of a guy who, though God keeps making him promises, he keeps doing those things in the flesh that protect himself. He's not really genuinely trusting God all the way along. For instance, we just saw it. He goes in among the Egyptians, or he goes in here among the Philistines and Canaanites, and he lies about his wife for fear that they would kill him. He's walking around with a promise from God, through you all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed, you're going to have a natural seed, and yet he's out there lying about his wife because he's fearing for his life. Well, that's not real, genuine, trusting faith in God, is it? And I didn't mean to look right at you as I said, is it? But it was your opportunity to confirm me and say, why, yes, Jim. He waits after he's been told you're going to have a natural child. He waits for a few years and then decides it's not happening. And into the tent he goes with Hagar. So he has this history of doing these things where God says, I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to give you these things. I'm going to provide for you. And he keeps waiting a little while and then going, I think I can do this better. I think I can work this out myself, and putting his own plans into motion. So now God has finally given him this child of promise, Isaac. And he has said to him now, in Isaac, your seed will be called. And now God is going to use a really interesting phrase and call Isaac Abraham's only son. Isn't that interesting? Because is he technically the only son?
No.
No, there's a first son. There's an elder son. There's the son by the bondwoman. But that's why first Moses had to establish, cast out the bondwoman and her son. They will not be heir with the child of promise. In Isaac shall thy seed be called. And from that point forward, God saw Isaac as the promised child, the promised son, Abraham's only son. Now that's really interesting, because what that means is, especially when you compare it to how the New Testament writers pick up that relationship and use it as proof of God's electing grace, it shows us one more time that God's election is not merely election out of hell. And it's not merely election to salvation, as grand as that is. But the result of God's election is also relationship with God. The kind of relationship where he refers to you as his child, as his son, as his daughter. And the whole world, the whole rest of the world, doesn't get that nomenclature. Everybody who is chosen by God are referred to as sons and daughters of God, sons of God. In fact, you even find it in the book of Job where the sons of God were gathered before God, before his throne. All the angels are referred to as sons of God. And yet, when speaking of Jesus, he becomes his only son, his only begotten. Why? Because Isaiah refers to him as the elect, the chosen one. So this language of election is more than just election to salvation. It is also God choosing to begin and sustain a relationship with you that is a familial relationship. It is not just God has chosen you to be a next door neighbor, or God has chosen you to be a close friend. It's he's chosen you to be family. He's chosen you to be his child. And so the same way that Jesus is spoken of as being chosen and elect and the Son of God, we see here that Isaac is referred to because he's the chosen, the elect one. Through him the seed will be called, and therefore he's the only son. In God's eyes, Isaac is the only son of Abraham. Now there's a physical reality, this other child, but that other child is sent off. Send away the bondwoman or child. He's a physical reality, but in God's mind and heart and electing grace, he's not a son. See the relationships? Now that should, one more time, expand our thinking about what it means to be the elect of God. Because it means that God has chosen long-term familial relation with you. You're in the family. That's why the New Testament speaks of adoption, that we are adopted through Christ into the family of God. And we become brothers and sisters in God's family, and we look to our elder brother, Christ. And that language is so great because he goes from being called Kurios and Master and Lord and all that language that says, well, he's the king and the ruler and the king of kings and the Lord of lords. And yet once you're elected into the family, he becomes big brother. And then Paul will say that we come boldly to the throne of grace Not running in saying, oh Lord and Master, who can wipe me out with a flick of your finger. You run in shouting, Abba, Father. It's a completely different relationship. So part of what we've been elected to is relationship with God that the world simply cannot have. And if they do not have that relationship, they're not considered in God's economy to in fact be sons and daughters of God. Only if you are the elect are you called sons and daughters of God. And we see it starting right here. Isaac is called Abraham's son, his only son. And that's remarkable because we know the physical reality. We know the first kid. We know the one that Abraham worked it out in the flesh and produced. But we know that God discounted that and said, no, that's a child of the flesh. That's a child of the works. And that's not a child that I elect. Because God's electing grace is the foundation and the basis of his relationship with any person. Which also means, as long as we're talking about that, and I like to stress this, so I will again, that God was under no obligation to choose or elect you. There was nothing you could do to obligate him to choose you. And if that's true, if we believe that, if we get a hold of that and say, right, I can't think of any particular thing about me that is so commendable that God would be required to choose me to be part of his family because I'm just so good, I'm just so righteous or so upright, or I read my Bible every day, I spend enough hours in prayer, I'm so good, of course God would elect me. I can't understand why he would elect Tom, but of course me. I mean, I've got all this going for me, you know. If you can't... yeah. No, if you can't think of any reason why God would elect you, then it takes us right back to that core concept again. It's all about his grace. And for reasons that we can't comprehend, he took us vile as we were, sinners that we were, and said, but you will be mine, and not just mine, not just my servant, but my son, my child, my daughter. You're in the family now. And Christ becomes big brother to you. God on the throne becomes Abba, Daddy. So that's exactly what's going on here when God says, take now your son, your only son, Isaac. Do you think God knew about the other child?
Sure.
But in his economy, and he wanted Abraham to think this way, this is your only son. Because this is the son of promise, this is the son of freedom, and this is the one through whom your seed will be called. Now, hold on very tight to that concept, because God has already told him, through Isaac, the promised child, now your only child, through him, all your progeny is going to come, and they're going to inherit this land, and they're going to get all these promises, and all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed through this child. So here's what I want you to do with this child through whom everything I promised you is going to come to pass. I want you to take that kid and kill him. Can you see how counterintuitive that would seem to Abraham? Okay, but this is the one I waited for all those years. I had 25 years of waiting for this kid. And now he's here, and now kill him. That's what he's told to do. Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, and look at what he adds. Whom you love. God knows this is going to be hard. Yeah, the one you love, your son, yes. And get into the land of Moriah and offer him there for a burnt offering. Now, Abraham's had a little experience with burnt offerings. You know what a burnt offering means? First, you prepare a bunch of sticks to burn, and then you don't just throw the kid on the fire, crackle, crackle, crackle. You have to actually slice his throat with a knife and bleed the blood out of his body and burn him. With the sacrificial lambs, I don't know if you've been watching what's been going on this week over in Israel, with this being the week of Passover. I don't want to call them a radical group because they're really just trying to keep the mandates of their own religion, but there are Jewish groups over there that have been trying very hard to get up on the Temple Mount this week and sacrifice a lamb because it's Passover. And of course, the government officials are keeping them from doing it because they're afraid of the outbreak that would happen between the Muslims and all of that would happen if they managed to get up there and sacrifice a lamb. But it was their intention to hang a lamb by his back feet. And they found a Cohen. They have a priest who could trace his family lineage back 1,000 years. And he qualifies as a priest. They found a spotless lamb. They have the qualified lamb. And they want to hang him by his back feet and slice his neck open. and let him bleed out and then kill him and burn him right there on the Temple Mount, because that's what a burnt offering is. So God didn't just say, kill your son who you love. He said, I want you to make him a burnt offering. Now, it's easy to read by that and go, oh, well, that's Abraham, you know, and, well, he's a man of faith, and, well, that was a long time ago, and kids didn't mean as much back then. No, it was different then. People walked and talked with God, and it was all different. Now, any of us that are parents, think for a moment. You would have a very serious crisis of conscience, or else you are no parent, when God says, not just kill the kid, kill him in a gruesome way. Tie him down, and then slice his neck open, and while he's bleeding out, burn him for my glory. Yes, ma'am.
And you know, he was over 100 years old, because this boy was 20. At least that's what my translation says. About 20.
Nobody's particularly sure. Those are wide estimations.
And I'm thinking, you know, if I was the kid, I would have been going, what are you, crazy?
Yeah.
You want me to do what?
Yeah.
You're going to tie me up?
Yeah, that's sort of the subplot of the story as you see it develop here tonight. You're going to see that Isaac, for some reason, goes along with all of this. And you have to assume that if he wanted to push the old man over, he could have.
And Abram, being the father who loves this boy,
yeah,
you know, it's a tremendous amount of faith. I mean,
and yet he's going to do it.
Yeah.
Isn't that remarkable? I mean, you are talking about a guy who has a long history of not doing things God's way. God keeps saying, do it like this, and he keeps going, well, I'll do it my way. I'll protect you. Oh, she's my sister. He has this long history of being stubborn, like most of us humans are, and trying to work things out his own way. This time, he's really, really trapped. God says, here's what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And now this is either do it or don't. This is black and white. Yes, sir.
And also, to underscore Abraham's affection for Isaac, when Isaac quit nursing, he threw the big big party to celebrate the child and his growth and maturity.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no way to conclude anything other than exactly what God says here, your son whom you love,
exactly. And
everything that that entails. So keep flesh and blood on this man for a moment. Verse 3, Abraham rose up early in the morning and saddled his ass and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood, or tied the wood for the burnt offering. And he rose up, and he went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, now this is a very interesting phrase, because he said to his young men, you stay here with the donkeys, and I and the lad, now this is where I have to pause for a moment, because lad is the translation, it's not man. When you said he's about 20 years old, there's a Hebrew word there for child that's translated lad. It doesn't seem that he had reached adulthood yet, but that he was considering him to be a younger man. That's why I said there's still controversy about the exact age. He says, you stay here, I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and come to you again. Now that's remarkable. Because he said, you guys stay here with the donkey, I'm going to take the lad and the wood and the fire, and we're going to go over on that mountain and we're going to worship God. Now we don't seem to have a burnt offering with us. But we're going to go over there and worship, which means we're going to kill something. And then he says, and we'll be back. Turn to Hebrews 11 for a second, because in Hebrews 11, the writer of Hebrews, in what's classically called the Heroes of Faith passage, picks up that very thought and says that Abraham expected that God, if he killed Isaac, was going to raise Isaac back up. That Abraham had so much faith in God at this moment that he was doing the seemingly impossible. He was taking his child up on Mount Moriah in anticipation of killing him, and yet knowing God is this time going to have to do something miraculous to preserve this lineage, to preserve this seed, because if he doesn't, then all his promises are negated and no good. So he's marching up the mountain with his son in anticipation of killing him. And there's nothing, by the way, in the text, I've heard people try to skirt this, there's nothing in the text that says or even implies that Abraham had any other intention than killing his son. That was his anticipation. But equally, his anticipation was, and we'll be back, because the boy I'm about to kill has the promise that through him, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And God is going to do something. I don't know what, but we'll be back. Do you have Hebrews 11 there? 17 to 19, more or less. Why don't you start at verse 17 and read it for us, Tom?
By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from the death.
So the writer of Hebrews picks it up and says, Abraham assumed that God could raise Isaac from the dead. And then he adds, and figuratively he did. Because they were going up on that mountain with the intention of killing Isaac. And in the end, they did both come back down. Now, the question is, how is it that they both came back down? Did Abraham actually kill his son? And did God raise him up from the dead? If he had done that, then I would agree that Isaac was the type of Christ. But instead, what we're going to see is God teaching substitutionary atonement. Verse 7, and Isaac wisely, notice that the kid catches on, and Isaac spoke unto Abraham his father and said, "Yo, Dad." That's my interpretation of it, because you got to figure, you were flipping like mad to find that one. Because you have to assume he's a little nervous at this moment. And the King James says, "my father." But I don't think it was just "my father" at that moment. I would like to read it with a little nervousness to my voice. Because he actually asks him, "my father," and Abraham said, "here am I, my son." And Isaac said, "behold, the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" That's a really, really good question. Isaac's starting to figure out, we're going up here to kill something, and Dad seems quite resolute in whatever it is we're about to do, because we've journeyed 3 days' journey just to get to this particular hill, and now we're going up this hill, and he's going to kill something, and we don't seem to have anything. And so he asks the question, where is the lamb? And his answer, verse 8, and Abraham said, "my son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering." So they went, both of them together. Now, depending on who you're reading and what commentary, you're going to see a couple different readings of that passage. Because the fact is, it's not real exact in the Hebrew. It can mean that Abraham anticipated the substitution, that he had some concept of substitutionary atonement and was saying, "don't worry, son, when we get up on the mountain, God will provide a lamb and it's all going to work out." That might be what he was saying. I doubt it. Because up till now, Abraham has no reason to believe anything other than he's going to kill his son. And when he gets up there, he doesn't get up there and start looking for a lamb. He gets up there and ties the boy down. So he may have also meant God has provided himself a lamb in that you've been born to us, the miraculous child. You're now that lamb that God requires. You're going to be the burnt offering. But it might also mean, because the word God and himself, a reference to God, is in the passage, it might also mean God will provide himself as a lamb. And that's a really interesting approach, because that is exactly what happened at Calvary, that God provided himself, God incarnate, to be the sacrificial lamb in substitution for his people. All of that is wrapped up in that answer. Now, which of those three approaches is the correct one? Jump ball. You guess. You read James Montgomery Boyce, he really emphasizes that third one. He really emphasizes that it was God providing himself to be a lamb. You read the more Arminian writers, they're really going to go with, you know, he understood that there was a substitute to be made and he was going to provide a lamb because they already know the end of the story. But Abraham didn't know the end of the story. So how would Abraham have concluded that? I'm more prone to think that the truth is somewhere in the middle there, that Abraham's anticipation was that they were going to go up there and he was going to kill the child and the child was going to be the burnt offering lamb. He was going to be the actual sacrifice. Verse 9, and they came to the place which God told him of, And Abraham built an altar there, which basically means he put some rocks on top of each other. And he laid the wood in order on top of the rocks. You have to imagine that at this point, Isaac's a tad nervous. And then he tied his son up. Now Isaac knows what's going on. He bound Isaac, his son, and he laid him on the altar on the wood. Now Isaac knows for sure what's up. I'm it. I'm the sacrifice. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. Now, who is Isaac prefiguring at that moment? As I said, the common interpretation is that he is a type of Christ because he's going to be a sacrifice, that he's in wood. I've even heard that one. Oh, Christ died with his hands in wood. Isaac's bound to wood. He's the only son whom Abraham loves, so Abraham becomes the type of God and Isaac becomes the type of Christ. No, 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 no. Christ is going to show up in just a moment. Isaac, he's you and me. We're toast. Isaac's you and me. You got fire underneath you and sure death above you. And that's all you got. And you're a sinner, born after Adam's race, and you're getting what you deserve. And you're about to be killed and sliced open and burned for God's glory, which is exactly what hell is. And that's all you got to look forward to in the natural. In your flesh, human beings, all you've got is death above you and a fire underneath you, and that's you. And I find that to be a much more satisfying understanding of what's happening at this moment. So Abraham stretches forth his hand, and he took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. Now that's a really intense moment. Because he's got the knife, he's going for his throat, he's lighting the fire, and at that moment an angel of the Lord says, Abraham, and you know Abraham had to have gone, phew, wow, that was close. Said, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And the angel said, do not lay your hand upon the lad, neither do anything unto him, for now I know that you fear God. Look at that phrase, now I know you fear God. That means in all their relationship, ever since he was called out of Ur of the Chaldees, up until then, God kept watching Abraham doing the wrong thing and misstepping and making bad choices and hiding and lying and in the tent with Hagar. And he kept waiting. And in that progress, in the progression of his relationship with God, he finally reached the point where God said, okay, now I know that you will trust me. Yes, you had your hand up.
I don't want to go too far off on a trail, but the way that the angel of the Lord speaks is not the way that an angel would address the whole situation. And thus, it's some sort of theophany.
Angel just means what?
Messenger.
It's a messenger of God. So it's a speaking agent for God.
Right.
And he ends up saying, I know you trust God. And in a moment, he's going to make it personal and say, me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the whole difference.
And could very well be the Christophany. We know that the word, the logos, according to John, is the speaking agency for God. This could very well be Christ in a pre-incarnate state stopping and talking to him.
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
And this is not something you need to get into now necessarily, in case it is something of a tangent, but maybe give some thought to. You know, there was the earlier occasion where we were told that Abraham believed God.
And it was counted for righteousness.
As righteousness, yeah. Right. So, you know, is there something maybe subsequent here that's of significance in light of that, maybe in some way even parallels our experience and walk with God?
Absolutely, and it's not a tangent, it's where we were headed. Yes, because if we see anything here, the relationship with Abraham and God, just like the relationship with Peter and God, we see Peter's failing and sticking his foot in his mouth and everything else, but it is Jesus that always restores him. It is always Christ that restores the relationship between them, and Peter grows and progresses until the end of his life, and according to best legend, is crucified upside down because he didn't think it was right to even die the way his Lord did. That's a far cry from the Peter we see in the Gospels. And so we see in the Bible these personality profiles of people that God chooses and secures And yes, he believed he was going to have the son, and God counted it to him for faith. And that is the beginning of our relationship with God. God speaks, we see his word, we come in contact with it, we believe it. That faith is counted as righteousness to us, and we are secure with God. But he doesn't leave us in that ignorant state. In Abraham's case, it took 25 years for God to reach the point of saying, okay, you trust me. I see people nodding all over the room going, yeah, that would be me. It took me a long time. I'm still on that path. I am still on the potter's wheel, spinning around like mad, being formed and reformed and reshaped. And every time he goes, all right, that's a decent looking vessel. I'll manage to break an arm off or something, you know. And all right, back to work, back on the potter's wheel. And then he lets me go. And before I can get to the killing, I just flop down into a big lump of clay again. And we start spinning again. And here we go. And I mean, but that is our relationship, and I think it's very reassuring to see it in the Bible, that people like Abraham, who we do see as the father of faith, and yet we see that it was a progressive thing. We see that God worked with him and worked with him and worked with him, and we see the progress of his failings and his tripping and his lying and everything else, and yet God didn't ever abandon him. Instead, God taught him and brought him along, but look at what he did. He taught him by giving him progressively more difficult tests of faith, which created in him that confidence that God was looking for. And so we go through our lives and we say, oh man, this one's going to kill me. Right. That's the point. God is continually making us turn to him as our only source of trust and security. Now, this is great because the angel speaks. As Mike said, it could be the Logos, the Christophany speaking, because he first says, don't lay your hands on the lad, neither do anything for him, for I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So he starts by speaking of God, the Father, and then he turns it to, and you haven't withheld your son from me, which makes it the Godhead speaking in a first-person form. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and he looked. And behold, now this is remarkable, because apparently when they got there, there were no animals. No rams, no lambs, no bulls, no. But he lifted up his eyes and behold, behind him. Isn't that an interesting phrase? He looked behind him and there was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. Now let's think. What's a thicket? Briars? Bush full of thorns. A bush full of thorns, and which part of his body was caught in the thorns? His head, his horns. There was a ram with his head in thorns. Do I need to explain it? Looks behind him at the moment of death. Sure death, fire below, and the knife that requires that blood sacrifice and the burning that is required of you for your sin. At that moment, Christ intervenes, and the voice of God says, don't touch him, and he turns around, and there's the substitutionary animal, and it's a lamb with a head full of thorns. Substitutionary atonement. Abraham lifted up his eyes, and he looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt sacrifice instead of his son. There it is. Substitutionary atonement. Did God get the burnt offering he required? Yeah, absolutely. But did Isaac pay the price? No, why not? Because a lamb God provided that spoke of his son in perfect typological terms was provided instead. God was satisfied. God wanted a burnt offering. And he got the burnt offering. But he got the burnt offering of an animal that he used to substitute for Isaac. Why? Because Isaac was his elect. Isaac was the elect one, the chosen one, the seed through whom all these promises were going to come. And so who was the substitute on the behalf of the elect? Did that ram die for anybody else other than Isaac and his seed, his progeny, those that come after him? No. Did anything happen here that in any way benefited Ishmael?
Nope.
No. Ishmael's the firstborn son. Did he get the substitutionary atonement made for him? No. Substitutionary atonement is made for the elect. And the first place you see it in the Bible, it's very clear that it's only for the elect. I'm not teaching anything new. I talk substitutionary atonement every once in a while, and I say, and by the way, it's a limited atonement. It's limited to those people God has already chosen from the foundation of the world. People go, where do you get that? Everywhere. I got Jesus walking around saying things like, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. He says, because the master doesn't tell his servants what he's going to do. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do because I count you as my friends. And says, there is no greater love than this, than that a man would lay down his life for his friends. So who's he laying his life down for? His friends. He says, I am the great shepherd. And the great shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And then he goes to the Pharisees and says, you don't hear my words because you're not of my sheep. Was he dying for them? No, he said so. Paul picks it up later, even in talking about marriage, and says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for the world. Isn't that a remarkable thing for him to say? It's because that's not what he said. You all looked at me quizzically like, did Jim just quote that right? No, he loved the church and gave himself for it. It's so clear all the way through the Bible, from the first time you see it until the last time you hear it referenced in the Bible, that Christ died for his own. He died for the elect. And it's prefigured all the way back here. He died as a substitute for Isaac, because Isaac's the chosen. But nobody else on the planet got the benefit of that. Why? Why Isaac? Was he better, faster, cooler, keener? No, he's just like his father. He's just a human, fleshly person, but he was chosen of God, he's in the family, and therefore God is going to provide absolutely everything necessary for his full eternal salvation. And that's going to include God providing for himself a lamb. And he provides that in Christ. I could preach the gospel from anywhere in this Bible. It's just all through this Bible. It's just woven all through it, the same story being told over and over again. God chooses, God elects. It's not Ishmael, cast him off and the bondwoman. It's not by the law, it's by promise. It's by choice, it's by election. And I send my son as a substitute for the elect. It's all the way through this text. And Abraham, verse 14. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh. What does Jehovah Jireh mean? The Lord will provide. It also has in it this concept of seeing, that God will see to it. That God, who sees everything, will see to it that it's taken care of. And so this idea that God will provide, he called it that because he got up there with intention of killing his son. And did God provide? Yes. Did God see to it? Yes. God, who sees everything, saw to it that there was a sacrifice appropriate and available to substitute for the seed. So he called the name Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time. Now, starting at verse 16, for those of you who are keeping count and writing little numerals in your text, this is now the sixth telling of the Abrahamic covenant, starting at verse 16. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven the second time and said, by myself have I sworn, says the Lord, for because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, that in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore, thy seed shall possess the gate of your enemies. Israel, the descendants of Abraham, have they ever possessed the gates of their enemies? Have they ever controlled all of their enemies and their coming and going?
No.
Has any of this taken place?
No.
God lying?
No.
What are you going to do about that? It's part of the Abrahamic covenant right here. He just added another element to it. And by the way, he already said earlier, those that bless you, I'll bless. Those that curse you, I'll curse. That's a good deal. But now he's added to it, you'll possess the gates of your enemies. Now, whatever that means, and however you define it, you can't show it to me in history where the descendants of Abraham physically ever possessed the gates of their enemies. It doesn't exist. Now, I have heard plenty of spiritualized interpretations of it, that somehow we, the church in Christ, that we are the spiritual offspring of Abraham, and that the gates of hell will not prevail against Christ's church. And in that way, we, the church, have possessed the gate of our enemies. Isn't that an interesting interpretation? Yeah, that's one of these kind of interpretations. That's about how good I dance right there. That was it. Yeah, that's why I don't dance publicly right there.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Yes, I know. I digress. Now, let's talk about the unconditionality one more time of the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant was established between God and God in two immutable figures passing through the animals and establishing the Abrahamic covenant. And I keep saying it is an unconditional covenant. And now here God has laid out the only possible condition you can attach to it, except that he also said, and you did it. So in terms of the Abrahamic covenant being passed down from this point forward, is there any condition attached to it? None whatsoever, because listen to the words here. By myself have I sworn, says the Lord, for because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son. So even if there were a condition, if we could say that the condition of the Abrahamic covenant was the willingness to sacrifice Isaac, that condition's still fulfilled. So there's still no condition to be found anywhere in the Abrahamic covenant. God said right here, I swore it by myself. I'm going to do this. That in blessing I will bless you, and in multiplying I will multiply your seed as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So even if that was a condition, the condition's fulfilled. So God is going to do everything we've seen so far cumulatively in the Abrahamic covenant, and yet without condition, which means God has to do it, or God lied. Yes, sir?
I was curious. I'm looking at, in this instance, I think this is a KJV.
Mm-hmm.
It reads, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. I'm wondering if it might be the same seed, which is ultimately Christ, being referred to in both of those instances, when he says, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemy rather than their enemies. In other words, it seems to be singular, personal pronoun, masculine there.
The New King James Version says there.
There. Yeah. Yep.
I don't know how it reads in the original. That's why I was asking the question about that.
And I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know exactly. And that's kind of what I referenced earlier, is that interpretation that says that the seed is Christ singular. But that theology of the singularity of Christ being the seed isn't developed anywhere here yet. We haven't seen that. How would Abraham have understood this stuff? Would he have understood references to the seed and all the nations of the earth being blessed? Would he have understood that to be, well, the particular seed, Christ, who will come and die as a substitute? Would he have understood any of that?
Most likely not.
Most likely not.
Although Paul does interpret
seed. Absolutely.
The point of it being in the singular.
Right.
As being Christ.
And says, and Christ is the seed, which is very important because it helps us understand what I've been talking about for weeks and weeks here, this seedology thing. That what that means is that God picked and chose the particular lineage and genealogies through which Christ would come, which is the importance of the genealogies in Matthew and Luke. So that we can understand what all this seed talk is about. And when God says, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, that we understood that the blessed lineage, the chosen lineage, was going to be through him. But to make the leap from there to, well, what that really means is Christ, the particular seed, is going to possess the gate of his enemy, and that's the gates of hell, and therefore that's fulfilled in some way, I'm really dependent on a New Testament author to tell me that. Short of that, I have to understand it in its original context, which is physical land, physical lineage, number of people, stars of the sand, seas. Why suddenly from that point we would leap to a spiritualized gate, I don't know. Because the context is all physical lineage, physical seed. You've got enemies, here's the land, possessing the land around you, possessing the gates of your enemies. All of that is physical language. So unless I can find a New Testament author that says, now what this means is, then I've got to assume that he means this stuff quite literally. Because as you continue through the Old Testament too, you see that stuff happen. You follow the seed as it grows and expands and becomes a nation and possesses that land, all of which happens in a physical fashion.
Well,
So,
well, there certainly is a dual fulfillment, you know.
You have lots and lots of things.
We're blessed through seed and lineage of Abraham, ultimately in the most significant way through Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the same might be said of the gate of one's enemies, that that's also maybe a dual fulfillment in some way. And isn't there also some reference in Revelation of the door or the gate or the opening to the abyss? I'd have to go back and look.
No, there is Revelation. A seal on the abyss, and the only gates that are talked about are the gates in New Jerusalem.
Okay. So, not reference there.
No, that would be a tough one to connect.
Christ having some kind of dominion over that.
What is the definition of the word gate?
You're talking about a walled city, and the only way in and out would be through the gate, a gigantic door that would be barred and closed. To possess a city, you have to possess the gate of the city.
Because I was thinking of the verse, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one come to the Father but by me.
Yeah, in that case, he said, I'm the door. But he was talking about a sheepfold.
That's why I wondered what the definition of the word gate was.
Yeah.
Because, you think of it as the physical thing.
Right. It's not a confusing word. It means exactly what you think. It is that front, gigantic, big old door. And it's used exactly that way through the rest of the Old Testament. When God speaks to Isaiah, predicts Cyrus, the Persian, and he says that he's going to open the gates in front of him. And that's exactly what happens. He takes Babylon by going in under the river, and they open the gate, and the army comes in. I mean, gate always has to do with that front wooden door, the only way in and out of a walled city. So if you have enemies that live in walled cities, there's no way you're going to be able to take them unless you get through their gate. So to possess the gate is a very important part. It's also why the elders of the city would often meet sitting in the gates. You see a lot of that. You see a lot of talk in Jesus' day about the gates of Jerusalem, and the gates are all given different particular names. When the enemy attacks, you close and bar the gates. So it has a very consistent meaning all the way through the Bible. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
And we're not countries now that have these kinds of cities.
Right.
Do we leap to a more spiritual understanding of this, or a more general?
I don't know if I would say spiritual, but I think your word general or symbolic, yes. When you see New Jerusalem, this is where Revelation does kick in. All of Isaiah's predictions, all of Jeremiah's predictions, all of Hosea's predictions about the regathering of Israel. The most important aspect of the regathering of Israel is that all the Gentile nations will flow to Israel, because that's where God is and that's where the blessings are. And they'll be told that they have to come up to Jerusalem, and they'll be living at complete peace, and none of their enemies will ever be able to, rise up against them. Well, yes, that would be then the fulfillment of them possessing the gates of their enemies. They control the aggressive nature of all their enemies. But again, to make the leap, and that is a sort of a symbolic understanding, but to make the leap from that to a spiritualized understanding of, well, this means the gates of hell, is such a stretch from the meaning that that word has in a physical sense all the way through, all the way up to Jerusalem and the gates that Jesus is walking in and out of, that to leap from there requires for me something in the text that takes me there.
Plus, it would seem that why would they use this verbiage? They would just say, it's the gates of hell.
Exactly. And it's such specific verbiage. Again, it's very common verbiage that as soon as he heard it, he would understand it. And all the generations after him who received that promise would understand it. And they would only understand it a way. It has a very natural physical meaning, which meaning didn't change all the way up through Christ's time and well past that. There are still lots of Middle Eastern cities that have gates.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to spiritualize.
No, I'm sorry.
What called my attention was the singular, both with gate
right.
and his.
Right.
And, to think of Christ fulfilling something, I don't think is spiritualizing something, because that's going to be a very literal, physical fulfillment.
But I guess I would put it this way. We know that the book of Revelation speaks of the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven onto the earth. But each of the 12 gates has the name of one tribe of Israel on it. Now, what do we expect those to be? Expect them to be gates. By the way, it's where we get the idea of pearly gates. People say, you're going to heaven, there's going to be pearly gates. No, New Jerusalem has gates made of pearl. And so from Genesis to Revelation, you see this word gate used all the time the same way, always as the entrance to a walled city. So again, to move that meaning anywhere else requires a leap that the text would have to give me.
So where does the preterist position come from, that gate, the gate itself is Jesus, and that the seed of the nation thing is really in reference to Christ? Is it just, again, they've just supposed that, okay.
You start with a conclusion.
Yeah.
And then you work backwards, and wherever the text is counter to your conclusion, you abuse the text. Yeah.
I can understand that.
Okay, let's finish up here. Verse 18, in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. Verse 19, so Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. That takes him back to the area of Abimelech, where the whole story began. And it came to pass, after these things, that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah, she has also borne children unto your brother Nahor. Now, this might seem like just an arbitrary bit of genealogical information, except it's going to culminate in a woman named Rebekah. And so it's important to know that Rebekah was born to Abraham's brother, and that's why Abraham is going to send his servants to go find Rebekah, because he doesn't want his child, Isaac, his only son, through the seed, doesn't want him marrying a Canaanite. He wants somebody from his own family and his own lineage, and you're going to see God enter into that. We'll get to it in the coming weeks, where God is going to enter into it and send his servant in a very specific way to go find exactly her, Rebekah. So Moses is giving us the genealogy here so that we understand that Rebekah is Abraham's blood kin. So he told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah, she has borne children unto your brother Nahor. These are the two funny names. Huz, the firstborn, and Buz, his brother. That's just funny. I'm sorry. Huz, his firstborn, and Buz, his brother. And Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Hazah, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. And Bethuel begat Rebekah. These eight Milcah did bear to Nahor, Abraham's brother, and his concubine, whose name was Reumah. She bare also Teba, and Gaham, and Thahash, and Maakah. I'm glad those names aren't being used much anymore.
So Isaac is marrying his cousin?
Yes.
Rebekah?
His cousin Rebekah, keeping it in the family, yes. Which you remember that even Abraham, when he was accused of lying about Sarah being his sister, his argument is, no, well, actually she is. We have the same father and different mothers. So there's this purity going on right at the beginning of marrying within the family and racial distinction, racial characteristic, that Abraham right away is not willing to mess with. Not going to marry a Canaanite, not going to marry a Hittite, going to make sure that it's his family and his lineage that is raised up in the promised land. So we'll look at all that next week. Starting at chapter 23, Sarah's going to pass away, and so Abraham, being concerned that his lineage continue, is going to send his servants to go find a wife, and God is going to lead them very sovereignly right to Rebekah. And that's why that little lineage is in there. All right? Isn't that good stuff?
Yes.
The story of Abraham on Mount Moriah with Isaac. I grew up with that traditional interpretation of it, that Isaac was somehow a type of Christ and Abraham was a type of God willing to kill his only son. And I read that and went, yeah, okay. And once I decided, you know, I should go back and look at that again. I remember Mike, when I taught this once at our house, I remember saying, Isaac is not a type of Christ, and him going, whoa, what? You know, it has to be. What? No. And by the time I got done, he went, no, I think you're right. I think you got it. There's a type of Christ in there, but it's the ram with his head in thorns. That's the type of Christ. Isaac has to be you and me. Fire underneath, sure death above, and that's as much as we got going if it weren't for a substitute. And boy, that's the gospel. Yes, sir.
When God commands Abraham to take Isaac and sacrifice him, I'm going to assume that Abraham does not have the option of saying, nah.
You know what's interesting about it, again, I was talking about examples before of Abraham's consistent personality profile. Mm-hmm. Think about how often he argues with God, because you see it pretty consistently. He says, I'm going to go destroy the cities in the plains. And he argues with him. Well, what about if there's 50? What about if there's 45? What about if there's... I mean, he discusses these things with God all the time and has that sort of, well, what if I do this attitude? So, yeah, I do think it's significant that in this case, he doesn't argue. He just does it.
Well, but they're not commands. He's not telling God, no, you're not going to sacrifice Sodom and Gomorrah. Mm. But in this particular case, it's a command.
Go do it. Yeah.
And I'm saying if Abraham does not have the option of saying, no, I'm not, then how much of a test is it?
I think the fact that God ends up saying, now I know, that it had to have been a legitimate test because God seems satisfied with the outcome. If God ends up saying, now I know because you didn't withhold your son from me, then God knew that this was part of the process of getting him to this point where he trusted him completely.
So Abraham did have some option to turn his back on a direct command from God.
Well, he's still rebellious.
The big theological answer to that would be, no, I don't think ultimately Abraham had any choice. But I do think this was the end result of a 25-year process where God had been steering Abraham toward obedience.
He's finally broken.
And finally broke him to the point where he was willing to give God everything God asked for. Now, was he going to fail that test? I don't think so. Any more than I think that Jonah could have run away from Nineveh.
Right.
God said, you're going to Nineveh, and he argued, and he ended up in Nineveh.
Or Eve could have resisted the temptation of Satan.
Yeah. I mean, these things ultimately are in God's hands. But what you're asking about, again, is that compatibilism of God, you know? People do what people are going to do, and it ends up being exactly what God intended. So did he have the will to not do it? Ultimately, I don't think so. I think that God was going to make sure that this emblem of his son was made. But was God satisfied with the test? Yes. So to that degree, I have to say it was a legitimate test that resulted in exactly what God wanted done.
Well, that leads to, did Abraham anticipate a sacrifice? We'd have to say no to that if God commanded him, go sacrifice Isaac.
I think he intended to sacrifice his son.
Right.
Otherwise, he wouldn't have put him on the fire and put the knife above him. Otherwise, the angel wouldn't have had to interrupt him and say, hold it, don't do that. It was his intention to do it. But he also knew, and that's the interesting part of it, but he knew that this was the kid who had the promise. Stars and sand and all the nations of the earth and inherit the land. This kid had the promise. So finally, Abraham broke through the naturalistic way of looking at things that caused him to go in the tent in the first place and said, okay, God can do whatever God's going to do. He gave me this kid when neither Sarah or I could have produced a child, so he can raise him up again. And that's what the author of Hebrews is arguing, that he reckoned that God could raise him up from the dead if he wanted to, and then says, and in a type, he did get him back from the dead, because once he was willing to kill him, he got him back.
And he's operating under a command that he really can't resist.
No, I don't think he could have ultimately resisted either. I think this was such an important moment in God's progressive revelation of who he was and how he worked. I'm willing to believe that God would have slapped the kid on the fire if that's what it took.
Look at there. You got all five of the tenets of the doctrines of grace in that message.
Yes.
Irresistible grace.
There we got the irresistible grace in too. Well, there we go. So we got men are sinners. Right. We got election. We certainly did plenty there. We got limited atonement in there. And we got perseverance in it. Wow. We are so good. Without even trying.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.